Welcome to the new episode of the How to Trade Like a Pro podcast. I'm Wieland Alt, and in this episode, I have the honor to welcome Daryl Guppy. And with Daryl, I'm talking about his way to become a professional trader, how to trade in the Outback, and why China is the go-to market in the future. Now, before we start, take a closer look to the risk disclosure in the show notes, and now enjoy the podcast. I'm here together with Daryl Guppy, and I met Daryl first time in Jakarta. Daryl, we met on the IFTA conference, and we had a good discussion about trading, of course, and I'm so happy that you agreed on having this short or long, let's see, conversation about trading, life, business, and therefore welcome to the podcast, Daryl. So happy to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Wieland.
Daryl, without any delay, let's just jump right in. And what I also always like to ask people in my interview and my guests is, how did you come to the stock market, to the markets, to trading and investing? So how was the journey and when did it start?
Well, it's probably a little bit unusual for all the things that have happened. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was living in a very remote part of Australia. A bit difficult for people to understand. So let me put it into some context. The nearest town was kilometers away. That town was only 2,000 people. Mm. In between, there was nothing. There were no people. There were lots of cattle, but there were no people. Yeah. So it's an ideal situation to start trading. When I say isolated, I mean there was no telephone, no radio, no television.
Oh, wow.
We would get the newspaper once a week, and it would come in by what we call the mail plane. The plane would deliver mail and the newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I'd been knocking around, as we say, and we'd taken some holidays. We'd gone to Darwin, and we're sitting down, and I came across this magazine called, I think, Personal Investment, and it talked about the market. And I felt that I needed to do something with my meager amount of return to Arapuralan, which is where I was living at the time. I was managing a Aboriginal community and decided, as this Warren Buffett character had said in this magazine, think about buying companies that you know. Okay, what do I know? Well, I'd worked, I'd put haul roads in for oil rigs and gold mines and all sorts of odds and ends around that type of geology. So I thought, okay, we need to buy a good mining company. And that's what I did. And of course, having bought a good mining company, I wanted to keep it. So every week on an Excel spreadsheet, because that's all that was available, I'd put a little X as to where the price was. And the next week, I put another little X, and I created a line chart. There was no charting programs available. And I saw that the price went from 60 cents to $1.20. And I felt very, very smart. This is a way to make money. You got to make your money work. This is the way you do it.
Yeah.
And then the next week, it dropped back, and eventually it came down less than smart. But, you know, Warren Buffett said, invest for the long term. So I invested for the long term. So I kept on to it. And when it got up to $1.30, I thought, no, I'm not going to get caught again. So I sold it.
Yeah.
And only one problem. We would get one, but it was a week late. Mm-hmm. So what I was doing, I was creating a weekly chart lagged by 1 week. But I was lucky. When I sold, instead of getting $1.30, I was able to sell at $1.40. So that introduced me to two things. First, that the way by trading it, not by investing it, that the price moves are there, they deliver good returns on your capital. It's the cleanest and most effective use of using your capital. Mm-hmm. The second thing that it taught me, which is really important from our perspective as technical analysts, I was completely cut off from news. There is no way that I could have any inside information, let alone up-to-date information. Even if I read about the company in the newspaper, it was still a week out of date. So the idea that you could use some fundamental knowledge to trade was irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So what I had to do is I had to understand what the price activity was telling me, because everybody else knew a lot more than I did. That's my starting point. Everybody else in the market knows a lot more than I do. Yeah. But when money, buying and selling, then they leave tracks or patterns in the market.
Yeah.
And you will find patterns of behavior that led to highly probable outcomes. That's how I started. It took me 12 months to turn 2000.
Amazing.
That's another story.
Yeah, amazing. Because this is literally the birth of a technical analyst by definition, right? So, and I really love the story that you're getting out like with data a week late. And this is exactly what I mean. I think a lot of people are really going crazy about real time and everything, like just popping in and you have all the messages. And I totally agree. The less you have, the better it might be, because all this distraction and all the noise in your head and noise in the market, well, it just drives you to decisions you don't want to make. And therefore, just lacking some information, well, might be a good idea at all. So I really love that story.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So let's come forward. Let's move forward. What are we looking at? 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Now, I trade the China market and I've many, many years, for a decade plus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read Chinese. I speak a little bit of Chinese, but I have no way to access the information on the China market by reading Chinese newspapers, Chinese financial reports. When I'm trading in China, I'm in exactly the same situation as I was when I first started trading.
Mm-hmm.
But we are very consistently successful and profitable in trading in the China market, because all we have to look at is price and price activity.
Yeah.
Because of the difficulties in language, we are barred, as it were, from understanding all the fundamentals that are driving that particular market or individual stocks. Instead, mm-hmm. we focus purely on the technical analysis of the market to be able to extract continuous and ongoing profits.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also here, it sounds like a little bit you're an adventurer too. So, you know, just going into uncharted waters for yourself and just see, okay, what is going on here, and just looking for opportunities, finding your own way without, you know, looking too much to the left and the right, and just, you know, making your way to your own success and also in China. Yeah, I know you're very active in China right now as well, as business grows. And I mean, you're in the markets for ages, and for decades. So therefore, yeah, of course, sounds really, really cool. So, and you also have your own indicators. You wrote a lot of books. So how did this develop?
Well, the indicators developed because I needed to understand several things about the market. Like everybody needed to understand what was happening with volatility,
mm-hmm.
and that led us to what we call the countback line. I needed particularly to understand the psychology of the market.
Yeah.
Remember, when I first started, I'm in the middle of nowhere. I need to understand how other people are, their perspectives are on the stock that I'm trading. Are they enthusiastic? Are they pessimistic? Are they bullish? Are they bearish? But you quickly realize that there are, for ease of convenience, two groups in the market: traders, people like myself who are in and out fairly quickly, and investors who are in for the much longer stability, the basis, the foundation of the market. So I want to understand the relationships between those particular groups, because if investors are prepared to support the trend, then it gives us a safe entry point for short-term trading activity. I mean, I'm sitting on open positions at the moment. Our market has closed up. One of those positions has 10% profit, the other sitting on 30%, the other sitting on about 45%. So what do I do? I've looked at the chart. It takes me 3 minutes. No, I don't need to sell those. My question becomes here, not do I have to act on a stop, but how high do I think, how much momentum is left in to close it? How do I work that out? Combination both of understanding the psychology that's sitting behind those trades. For that, I use a Guppy model for moving average, and then transferring that to understand the volatility of what's mm-hmm. happening with price. And for that, I use a countback line, or what we call a trader's act, which looking at price volatility that will give me a stop if necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so. Yeah, I saw that too. So you have developed some kind of like rainbow with moving averages. So where is, well, where's the point in using so many moving averages? So basically, people use like 28 or 2010 or 50 and 200, and basically that's it. But folding out a rainbow is a different story.
Okay. Several things there. First of all, I made a mistake calling it Guffey model for moving averages. That is what it is, but it's not a description of what underpins it. Secondly, it is not a rainbow. It's very unfortunate that about that time, Mel Widener brought out what he called a rainbow display. It has nothing to do with Guffey model for moving average. So what we're doing with GMMA, let's see how it works. I'm trying to find a combination of averages that move the entry signal as close to the pivot point low of a downtrend as possible. In other words, I want an early entry.
Yeah.
We're stuck with limitations in software in those days. So the most averages I could put on, let's start with half a week. That's three. Five trading days, 3, 5, 8, 10, 12, and 15. That's six moving averages exponentially calculated, and that's essential. And what we see is this compression that takes place as there is an agreement about price and value. And as soon as there's an agreement about price and value, then there's someone going to come in and say, I think you're wrong. I think it's worth more or less than what the current market is saying. So you get this expansion that takes place. That's the first observation. The second observation, remember the limitation on the software, plot on a chart, a longer group of moving averages, in this case, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, and 60, because the Americans seem to fall in love with 60, then we see a repeated behavior. Now, for convenience, as representing the way traders are thinking, and the long-term group as representing the way that investors are thinking. Of course, we don't know, but for convenience, it's an easy way to discuss it. But what we see, even though the shortest average is 3 and the longest average is 60, the crossover points virtually simultaneous. They are virtually in the same window frame. So what it tells us is that every trend change is led by investors, but sorry, every trend change is led by traders. You've got much more intelligence than investors. Every trend change, but when investors join, when we see the same compression and expansion activity take place at the same time, then that's a signal that that breakout is sustainable and most likely to develop into a long-term trend. Think about it. I'm a trader.
Yeah.
I'm training every day. At the end of the day, my wife says to me, how did it go? You had a bad day. Oh, no, really, great, Gary, etc. I make the decisions. I don't have to consult with anyone.
True.
But if I'm an investor, typically a fund or fund manager, before I take a position, I have to convince a whole range of people that that's a proper allocation of money. So the result is that the investment decision is delayed. But when you look at investors, and I'm generalizing here, fund managers, et cetera, they're all using pretty much the same methods. And not surprisingly, they reach the same conclusions at about the same time. So we see this compression that takes place. But actually, if I want as an investor to build up my position, I've got to outbid my fellow investors. So we see the expansion take place. So what we see overall is a fractal repetition across multiple time frames. We have moments of stability within and inherent. So the simplicity of the moving averages hides a sophistication in the analysis and the application and what it's telling us about the market and market behavior. The crossover of the moving averages is, to a large extent, irrelevant.
Yeah.
It is the compression and the expansion activity that's important. So in a well-established trend, for instance, you will see a sudden, fairly dramatic plunge pullback with no impact on the long-term group of moving averages, and then tells you that's a safe time to buy for a rebound recovery.
Yeah.
In another situation, you'll see the same drop-off taking place and simultaneously a rapid compression in the long-term group of moving averages that tells you, hey, don't touch this. This is the time to go short. So although the basics, the moving averages, simple and basic and straightforward, it's the combination that gives you the insights into the behavior and the thinking of the two groups that drive the markets, not bulls and bears, The groups that drive the markets are traders and investors.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think you developed them on exponential moving averages, not just simple ones, not, you know, but not weighted, but exponential. Why is that? Because if you compare them, they're very close to each other anyway.
Because they're effective. Why that? Because they're effective. Of course, I played around with simple and weighted and all the rest of the combinations that are there.
Right.
But exponential moving averages, they give the consistent, reliable signals, whereas the simple and the weighted just simply don't bring through the relationships.
I see. All right. Okay. Yeah. It's simple, and on the one hand, from basic understanding how things work and just, you know, going with the market flow, market move. But on the other hand, it delivers exactly the amount of information you need just in terms of market dynamic and you know, how far a correction could go, a pullback, and how far away you are from, you know, let's say the fastest average. You know, if you're like really high momentum, you're even far away from the three period. I can figure out. So, and when do you take your profits according to this? When price crosses or when?
Okay, when you're bringing together several factors.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I'm a chartist. I'm not a technical analyst.
Yeah.
A very important difference there. Okay, so a chartist is using a basic chart. There is no manipulation of elements.
Mm-hmm.
A technical analyst is always manipulating price elements. The simplest way to think about it is the difference between a straight edge trend line drawn on a chart
mm-hmm.
versus a moving average crossover, which takes price and modifies it
mm-hmm.
to produce the averages.
Yeah.
Line does nothing to price at all. So there's a difference between a charting approach and a technical approach. John Bollinger and I argue about this all the time, but I'm sticking with my interpretation. So as a chartist, I'm looking for chart-based signals, a probability breakout. A simple trend, powerful tool in the market is a simple trend line.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up a pen and draw it. Use a mouse, plot it. A simple trend line gives you a highly reliable signal that a breakout is developing.
Cool.
Now, I want to modify that a little bit more to a limit, and for that, I use price volatility.
Mm-hmm.
And I use a self-adjusting measure of price volatility, which is a countback line. Now, that's different from something like ATR or parabolic SAR, for instance, because with ATR, you have to predefine what you think is the relation of the averages before the trend develops. You have to select 14 or 7 or whatever figure you think is appropriate for the calculation. In a parabolic SAR, you have to pre-select what you think the momentum or the acceleration figure is going to be before the trend develops.
Mm-hmm.
But with a countback line, a single volatility line. So what I'm looking for is three significant candles. And that's determined by, on a downtrend, candles that are higher than the previous high.
Yeah.
Once I've got that, and I've got a signal that's delivered, first of all, from a break from the straight edge trend line, confirmed with a volatility price volatility break using the countback line calculation, then I'll put a Guppy multiple moving average over it to further assess the behavior of the market. Does the behavior of the market support this chart analysis? If the answer is yes, that's when I'll buy.
Nice. Yeah. It's a great idea, basically. And I never thought about the difference between charters and technical analysts because, you know, this goes so deep. But it's definitely worth considering. And let's see where this leads me to in the thinking process further on. But it's a nice spark in my head right now.
Well, so think about it. Okay, chart analysis, trend lines,
mm-hmm.
support resistance level.
Yes,
that leads you to trading bands, band breakouts.
Yeah,
support and resistance levels, trend lines leads you to sloping down and sloping triangles, bullish flags, bearish flags, those simple hand, in the old days, those simple hand-drawn lines on the chart, head and shoulders patterns, etc. None of that requires manipulation of the underlying price data.
True. You just draw your lines, right?
Mm. Yeah. And yet there are key trading techniques, highly reliable techniques that involve just purely from that. Trading band analysis, take the width projected upwards, projected downwards. Triangles must have three sides. Use that, project your price projection targets up and down. Parabolic trends, they're all there. That's a primary toolbox that I choose to use. As I said, I'm a chartist, not a technical analyst. I only use the technical analysis to understand the thinking, the psychology of the market participants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, we look at, say, a bullish flag or an upward sloping triangle. They are patterns that have a high probability of reaching their projected price target.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I don't know. I don't need to know. All I need to know is that if I can accurately definability of outcome A versus any other outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem we're finding with social media and various charting platforms that pretend, and I use the word deliberately, that pretend they can provide this type triangle patterns. A triangle has three sides. It's a funny thing. It has three sides. That's what makes a triangle.
Yeah.
And it's the vertical side that's the most important, because it's the vertical side that allows you to project the price target when the breakout takes place.
Mm-hmm.
How many times on a number of charting platforms defined with two sides, a horizontal support resistance level and a trend line?
Yeah.
That's not a triangle.
Yeah,
that's where's true. The third side?
Yeah.
And unless you have the third side, then you're looking at something that's useless, because the importance of the pattern is not a continuation or all the rest.
No.
The pattern is it gives you a highly reliable way to set and project a price target. And from that, you can manage your risk exactly.
Mm. Yeah, true. Interesting point. Great. I mean, that's what I really love about talking with you, with other guests about trading, because all these different angles on the market, and as a listener, I would really carefully go into all these details and think about this for myself, because basically what trading and investing is about, it's all about your own decisions, what you already also mentioned, that you have to make your own decisions, you have to live with your results, so you better have your own view, right? So it's a great approach to this. Dara, let's jump over to China, because China is so much developing as well as Asia. I've been to Southeast Asia now for 5 months. I do this for a couple of years now, like every year being there. And I see so many opportunities over there. But I've never been to China, which I highly regret. And I hope to do this, and I will do this at the end of the year for the conference. And so how is China going? Because it, especially for Europeans and Western guys, it's so different. How's investing? How's business over there?
What do you mean it's so different?
Limitations.
I can show you a chart of a China stock. No. I can show you a chart of a China stock, and it's exactly the same as a chart of an American stock,
that's
or
true.
A German stock, or an Australian stock, or a Singaporean stock.
That's true.
That's the fundamental truth. We shouldn't use that term. That's the fundamental truth that underpins the technical analysis. What else do you need to know? You don't need to know all the rest of the fundamental stuff that goes with it.
Yeah.
I'm trading stocks in China at the moment. Okay. The China market is terrible at this point in time. It's in a steady, steady downtrend, and essentially it is in the short side.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to do it, but for the average trader, for the ordinary trader on the street, you can't trade from the short side. You can only trade the China market from the long side.
Yeah.
So we trade and we pick up 10 to 30% every week mm-hmm. on what we're trading.
Mm-hmm.
Pure technical analysis.
Yeah.
What companies are we trading? Haven't got a clue. Have not got a clue. I don't need to know.
Yeah.
Now, if you're confident, if you are truly confident in your ability as a technical analyst or as a chartist trading, then there are no barriers to trading in the China market.
Mm, true.
Of course, there may be some barriers, some mechanical ones around how you operate brokerages and so on. But in terms of pulling profits out of what's happening in the China market, there are no technical or charting barriers.
Yeah, saying that, yeah, it's true. I mean,
it makes it feel uncomfortable, doesn't it?
It doesn't. It's definitely it's the other way around, because it more encourages me to look closer into this, because, you know, there are a lot of opportunities. But, you know, coming from the retail side, where you're also working on your own, so you know what I'm talking about. People always talk about, you know, like forex trading, going short, you know, things like this. And if you go to think about China, that's impossible. And now you cannot do this. You cannot go euro, dollar, you know, stuff like that. But you're totally right. You don't have to do this anyway. You can choose something else, because markets are moving, and every market is more or less the same from that approach. But yeah, it's also necessary to widen your view on it a bit. And yeah, just go over that. Therefore, it's not make me uncomfortable, but it makes me, I have to think about things a bit more. But I'm really grateful.
Let's take it out of China.
Yeah.
Because the same issues exist if you're trading Singapore or Malaysia or Thailand or Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Not the language, but the fact that they markets, and we don't have a good handle, a good understanding of what the fundamentals are.
True.
And that's what prevents people from trading these opportunities. Oh, I don't know enough about Singapore. What do you need to know? What you're trading, what we are trading, price volatility.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter where it happens. Doesn't matter whether it's a commodity or a currency or a stock. Doesn't matter whether it's Germany, Australia, the US or the UK. We are trading price volatility. Now, I come from a mining background and done all sorts of odds and ends. And I can tell you one thing's for sure. It doesn't matter where gold's found, whether it's underground or in a stream or at the bottom of a lake, it's still gold. And that's what I'm after. It's the same in the market.
Yeah, true. Oh, my. Yeah, you're totally right. We're trading price volatilities. And I already got the headline for our discussion. And I really love that one too. And yeah, but leaving the charts, going over a little bit more into really economic side, because I know that you have a lot of speeches and you have a lot of very, very deep connections into China. And I think what's really interesting, I hope so, for most of the listeners or all of the listeners, is how is developing in China? How is where is the future for investing, for living? I think you have a bias here, but what do you think? What is your experience, your view?
That's because I've been in China frequently.
Yeah.
I was in China in December last year, and from the Western media, we're hearing the economy is collapsing, China's on the edge of disappearing sort of material.
Mm-hmm.
So what did we see? This is just an observation. There's no hard facts behind it.
Of course.
So in Beijing, a third or more of all vehicles were having had drink. Numbers that they are electric or mm-hmm. hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
The varieties of electric vehicles that were available is massive. It's not just one or two. It's not just Tesla. It's not just BYD. There's a whole range of manufacturers around that. You've got solar power being generated in Xinjiang as the equivalent. I'm trying to put it into your distances. It's like having solar power generated in Moscow
mm-hmm.
powering Paris. That's massive.
Yeah.
They're literally miles or kilometers ahead of what's taking place in the West. And that's what terrifies the Americans. The Chinese are so far ahead in so many areas that the Americans are struggling to catch up. That's why we're imposing sanctions and all the rest of the stuff that goes with it. We just mm-hmm. chop off their supply of chips because that hasn't really worked. Now, the advances that are taking place are substantial across a whole range of things. China's problem is that it is approaching or in the middle income trap. Now, the idea there is that you have rapid growth at the beginning because you can motivate labor and all the rest of the stuff. So you had the Asian Tigers coming back in the 1990s that were in the same thing. So they mobilized cheap labor forces and lifted people out of poverty. Then they hit a barrier.
Yeah.
What was called the middle income trap. Very hard to develop beyond that. Hit that barrier. It was the turn of the 19th century. They overcame that through Henry Ford and automated assembly lines, all the rest of it. That was what got them out of that middle income trap. So the answer is you have to lift productivity. How do you lift productivity in the current productivity? By moving to a digital economy. And that's where China's focus is.
Yeah.
So their movement towards the digital economy is not just the ease of payment with WePay and so on. Cash has virtually disappeared in that environment. It's very, very hard to pay for anything with cash. It's all done through, but goes beyond that. It goes through the use of blockchain to overcome both counterfeiting, to overcome corruption, because you can track the transactions. You have a guarantee that the product you're buying hasn't been tampered with. It hasn't been substituted with an inferior product. All of this increases the productivity in the environment. So what it means, two things. One, that you break out of the middle income trap because productivity has increased. Two, despite a falling population, you've got an increased productivity taking place that is more than capable, more than able to be able to service the silver economy, look after parents, all that type of thing that takes place. So yeah, what you're seeing there is a massive economic change in a digital economy that we're not seeing anywhere else in the world.
Yeah. Wow. Sounds amazing. And in parts I can agree, because I saw the same outside of China, but in Asia, Southeast Asia, I saw this in Japan. I had the same thoughts because everybody was talking about, the Japanese, they have so much problems in the demographics and people are getting old. So how can they get this done? You see everywhere, you know, some service robots, and you go to a restaurant, you go to vending machines, everything is done automatically. You just get your food, already have paid, you eat, go, done. You know, so that's just one impression, but it leads to that direction. And still there are a lot of young people as well, so should not be that big problem. But yeah, it's one way. And when I look to the other side, to Europe, it looks a bit different. Right, especially Germany, where we're fighting with lagging internet, speed still is something people don't know. You have like huge spots where you have blackout zones for your internet. For example, if you're going from Frankfurt at the Autobahn to the north, you literally don't have any connection anyway. And this has gone on for years. Yeah, it's true.
That's right. Surprising.
Yeah, it's really surprising. And then you ask yourself, okay, where's the future? Where can I invest in? I mean, we're traders. We're not really investing. We're just investing into the move. But people always think about that. Okay,
well, can I?
It's over, right?
If you're investing in China, then I'd recommend Moutai.
Uh-huh.
Who's your Moutai? It's a listed company. Because when times are good, people celebrate with Moutai. And when times are bad, people drown. That Moutai is a good long-term investment in China.
Ah, okay. Yeah. What is it?
Moutai is like snacks.
Ah.
Alcohol,
yeah.
Liquor.
That's always a good investment, you know?
Yeah. Because that's their natural. But all jokes aside. So it's because the Americans can't compete, they indulge in what I call mafia capitalism, mm-hmm. where they simply try to destroy or undermine the competition. So they use sanctions and tariffs and all that sort of thing. I mean, Trump's talking about putting 60% tariffs on. That'll be great. That'll really make 60% more. But what it's meant in China with those sanctions is that they have been forced to develop their own chips, their own chipsets, which essentially has created substantial competition to TSMC in Taiwan, which is a major chip maker that did.
Yeah.
The Chinese are moving ahead with chips in a rate that they've been forced to because of the sanctions, and that powers that economic development.
Yeah.
Look at the areas. We tend to say, China copies everything. Well, if China copies everything, why are the Americans so worried about them being ahead of them? Thanks.
Yeah.
So the current focus, for instance, is on rare earths, and certainly the focus is on rare earths in Australia, lithium and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Are they important? No. Already, China has automobiles, cars on the road that are powered by batteries. Sodium is generally known as salt. They are powered by sodium batteries. They've commercialized that already. That will eliminate very quickly the need for expensive, rare earth, lithium-based batteries in motor vehicles.
Yeah.
Worth it. Another Chinese company is in the process of commercializing the sort of batteries that are used on handphones and things like that. they need recharging once every 50 years.
That sounds like back in the Nokia days.
So how's that going to impact not just on phones, but a whole range of rechargeables that currently rely on lithium and rare earths?
Yeah.
These are advances that are taking place that don't get talked about much in the Western media. They are there in, let me call it, Asian media. So they're in South China Morning Post out of Hong Kong. They're in Channel News Asia out of Singapore. They're in China Daily in China and so on. But we don't, Western media doesn't follow what's happening there. So we are getting left behind. We don't even know we're being left behind.
Yeah, true.
In that future, the future sits very much with China in terms of its development. Because if we take Europe and the US, I won't say they've reached peak development, but the momentum of economic development within those regions is limited, whereas the potential continues to expand. That's what we need to tap into.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree more. And for again, I haven't been there yet, but I have seen what's going on around, and it's still already impressing. And also the perspective, if you go to Thailand, for example, the perspectives are huge. People are like really on the edge of having a better life, and they're really striving for it, and they want to have it, and they will have it. And this already gives them a lot of power, speed, and momentum. And if you combine this also with China, you have a huge market, and you have a lot of people just buying things, consuming things, and just imagine they're all sitting in planes traveling the world. Oh my goodness.
So there are lots of opportunities within that environment.
So maybe it's really worth, not just reading Western newspapers, where you're from, but also reading some maybe automatically IA translated news from China as well, and from the region to get a broader view. Excellent. Let's move on a little bit again back to trading. As you are, you are working with a lot of traders. You do trainings. I think you have offices in China as well, and in Singapore, is it right? And of course in Australia, right? Yeah. So from the trading perspective, do we experience any differences in behavior of the different regions of the traders in trading? For me, I can say Germans are a little bit more conservative when it comes to risk and jumping into a trade. They really need to know everything before they decide to make a move. I feel it's a little bit different in Asia. How is your experience?
Well, there are certainly cultural differences in the approach to the role that markets play within a household investment environment. So in the West, in Australia, the US, Europe, I think we can say that the market is seen both as an opportunity for longer-term investment, as an investment asset opportunity.
Yeah.
When we move to China, then the market is not seen as a longer-term investment opportunity. It's not seen as an investment asset. So there is a higher level of trading that takes place. Now, of course, the Americans say, oh, yeah, it's all full of retail traders and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, our markets are as well. And to that extent, the China market isn't dominated by the heavy institutions. So in fact, there's more opportunity for retail traders there than there is in European and Western countries. When you start working in Singapore, Thailand, and Malaysia, again, there are different attitudes towards risk, towards obligation and investment, to money management. But there is always that core of traders who are interested in trading the market. The execution methods, the structures of the market, the mechanics of the market, yes, they're different in Australia that you cannot do in Singapore. There are things you can do in Singapore that you can't do within China or Malaysia, for instance. So there are minor differences in the practical application of how you execute a trade. So, for example, we work in order-driven markets as distinct from quote-driven markets. US is all quote-driven. So you've got a market maker sitting between you and the execution of your order.
Yeah.
That's market manipulation as far as I'm concerned. For us, it's an order-driven market. My order sits there. my order and its execution. Mm. And I can see the full order line. I can see every order that's in front of me. I can see every order at every level, size, the whole lot. The Americans call that inside trading. For us, it's level three. It's a transparent market. And that changes tactics and methods that we use.
Mm-hmm.
So when I buy us and I'm basing it on a chart pattern and I know that it's going to hit $12, then I will put my sell order in at $11.99 because that means that if it hits its target, I'm guaranteed to be out of that market. Now, yeah. I can do that as soon as I buy the stock, and I can put a sell order in at $11.99, and it sits there, and it sits there at the head of that order line. It never loses its position until it's withdrawn or executed.
Mm-hmm.
But in Singapore, if I use the same method, then those unfilled orders are randomized at the beginning of each trading session. So I can't lock, so it changes the techniques that I have to use. If I'm involved in the China market, I cannot be involved in intraday trading. If I buy this morning, I cannot sell until tomorrow. So what's that mean? It means it's safer for me to buy towards the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So if there's an adverse move, I can get it. But if I buy in the morning and there's an adverse move during the day, I've got to hold on to it because I can't sell until tomorrow. So there's those sorts of differences that make that become important. The one that I love most of all, and I saw a great example in the Australian Financial Review, which is the daily financial paper in Australia. It was from Bloomberg, and it has disappointed Chinese investors standing in front of a trading screen that's full of red. Well, they wouldn't have been disappointed because in the China market, red is up and green is down. And if I'm sitting in front of a board filled with red, I'm really, really happy.
I love that psychology approach. Yeah, it changes everything. It's a game changer, but it depends what it makes to your account as well. And so, yeah, but it's a fun story. And it's also very interesting. So basically, there's no intraday trading in China unless you're going to gold futures, something like this.
That's right. Once you're into commodity markets, you're into intraday trading and so on, but in the stock market. So we're talking differences. It reminds me of one example. I'll have we're doing in China and 2010, 2013, 14, we ran a whole series of major conferences and we brought international speakers in. Mm-hmm. So we had an American speaker who shall remain nameless. And he stood up and spoke about the advantage. And he found from trading.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed him to live on a farm. It allowed him to mow the lawn and prune the trees. It allowed him to do a whole range of those things that we all see as the absolute advantages that trading the market brings to us.
Yeah.
He lost the Chinese audience completely because there's no way that they wanted to return to the countryside. Their life is getting out of the countryside into the city.
True.
There is no way that they would want to do looking after a garden or pruning trees or anything like that. Yeah. Well, he had a collection of vintage cars which he'd like to drive around. That wasn't the aspirations of his Chinese audience.
Yeah.
Now, what he had to say after that was very useful, but he lost the audience completely in that first 10 minutes because we're absolutely wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a great example of having two sides of the coin. In the Western, everybody is thinking, not everybody, but a lot of people are going like, I'm going to leave the country, I don't want to leave the city for better air, for more peaceful, quiet environment, whatever. And it's true, developing countries do exactly the same because living in a city, there are opportunities, there are jobs, there's money, you have all the good life over there. No matter what stage you are in, even though you're just like having like day-to-day jobs, still it's a better job and better life than having no job at all on the countryside. Yeah? So yeah, it's true. We always forget about this because we're living in our own bubble and feel like, this is the world, but it's not. Traveling the world, and you're traveling as well. I think you're speaking at 27 countries so far, what I have learned so far. And you saw a lot, and this really changes the view we look at the world and of the understanding we have of the world. At least it's for me, I'm pretty sure for you too.
I'm lucky in many senses, in the sense that I spent many amongst Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. Mm-hmm. And I was an administrator, a council clerk of the community. And so the first language was an Aboriginal language, a Yarra, not English. Mm-hmm. So there would be long conversations in a Yarra from which I did not understand a single word.
Yeah.
You know, you would ask a question and there would be language, and eventually yes or no, as the case may be. So you had to understand what was happening. You had to learn, like a chart, to read what people were doing, what their expressions were, what the culture was. And mm-hmm. and when I'm working in foreign countries, in China and Asia and elsewhere, then that becomes a very useful skill. But you can always do research.
Yeah.
Always do research. When you're in a country, you listen, you find out what's going on, you read the newspaper, you touch in so that you can work that into the presentations that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, get in touch with people over there. Just say, talk to the taxi driver, how's your life? You know, how's life? I always, wherever I go, I always ask people, how is living here? You know, it's great. So you really hear the truth. Somebody say, well, it's not that easy. Some say, well, it's great. What is the average, you know, what you pay for rent? How is price for local food and all the stuff? So you get some, so how is salary in general here? So you get a lot of information and then you can compare. And then you look, you know, then you look at the Western pockets, which are filled with money. And then you look in their pockets, which are basically not so full. But they look a very, very, you know, they still look a lot more happier than Western people do, from my point of view. You know, like everybody's like fed up in the Western country. Everybody's like concerned about government, price explosion, whatever. And if you go to the more developing countries, everybody is happy to be alive, to have a decent outcome, you know, to be with friends and family. Usually sun is shining, which helps, I guess. But, you know, so it's always good to learn more about the countries and how you can live in there.
We have to be very careful with confusing survivor bias with happiness.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But still, it's some kind of positivity, it's saying like this, coming over. Or what do you
yes,
think?
I would agree.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But you're true. It's not always like being heavy like crazy. They struggle a lot sometimes, but still they have some kind of positivity of life and a different approach. Not complaining so much. I think that's more the better part. Yeah. Or better point of that. All right. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Dara, I'm just looking at the watch and I just see we're already touching 1 hour. So I don't want to steal too much of your time for this. Maybe we can continue if you like soon and continue with the discussion. But I think from now on we really covered a lot of ground, and I'm so grateful and honored that you really invested some time here to talk with me about trading, China, life, experiences, and yeah. So let's see where we meet next. Hope so, in China, of course.
Okay, hopefully, yes. Yes, and meeting again in China would be very good.
All right. Thank you so much, Darren. That's already it, and I really hope that you enjoyed this episode and you took away some learnings for your personal trading. If you want to learn more about me, about my interview partners, if you want to have a one-on-one coaching or even get into a training course with me or my interview partners, just get into the show notes and follow one of all these links you find there, and then I will be happy to hear and see you again. Your Wieland.